Welcome. My name is Dr. Lauren Cohen, and I am your host for the Spiritual Success Summit. We are here to pull back the curtain to reveal the challenges, myths, and misconceptions that we often experience when applying the principles of consciousness and spirituality into our lives, and to provide practical and tangible solutions so you can successfully create the spiritually inspired life you desire. Today's guest has been on a spiritual journey through which she recognized that stress and negative emotions fragment our energy and leaves us powerless. She realized that the way to regain our power is to bring these fragments back together into one cohesive, powerful entity, resulting in the acceptance of all of our parts and a growing sense of acceptance of ourselves exactly as we are. I'm really happy to welcome Srilepa Mela with us today. So, Srilepa, welcome.
Hey, Lauren. Thank you so much for having me. I am thrilled to be here talking about a subject that I love. So, thank you.
Oh, wonderful. Yes, I'm really excited because I know, you know, we had some conversation earlier on that really was a really important facet of the spiritual journey, and I'm really excited to bring this conversation forth. But before we do, can you share a little bit about your own journey?
Sure. So I had sort of been on a search of around between the ages of 15 and 19 or so, and then at the age of 19, I lost my mother, who was really my closest friend in the world. She died in a plane crash. And it just threw me off completely because I had not yet developed a whole sense of self. And then there were a lot of other things going on around me in the family, which made me the kind of unexpectedly the matriarch, and so there, and there was, you know, alcoholism, and there was a lot of stuff going on, and there was a constant battle in my head about do I believe and do I not believe. And growing up in India, of course, you grow up surrounded by the mythology, and you grow up hearing the stories. I didn't actually grow up in a very religious household, so it was not a very ritualistic upbringing. But, and so there was a question, and my mother was an agnostic, so it took me a long time, several months long, it seemed long at that time, and I couldn't figure out what to do, and finally I just really got tired of it, and I was walking to school one day, and this questioning was going on in my head, and I just said, forget it, I'm just going to live as if I believe, and let's see where that takes me. And it was, I sort of remember so vividly standing, you know, where I was standing in Bombay and what I felt and how I spoke. And so then I just basically decided to live as if I believed in God, and started behaving like, so, you know, having conversations, having going to that source for to get guidance and answers. And there was an interesting thing that happened, which for me was a sign that I was being heard somewhere. As a result of my mother dying, I had initially grown up telling my mom that I didn't want an arranged marriage and I would find my own guy and all of that. But just after all of this, I decided I didn't want to hurt my father much more, and so I decided to have an arranged marriage. My marriage was fixed in about 5 days, about a year and a half after my mom died. And one of the things that I really wanted, I had really got into the Bhagavad Gita at that time, and one of my really heartfelt desires was that I wanted to go into a family where there was a spiritual practice. And there was also, I also kept speaking with Krishna, who is my sort of deity of choice in Hinduism, and sort of offering myself to him, in a sense, surrendering and saying, this is not what I thought was going to happen, but I'm there. That's Ella shaking herself. But I'm laying myself at your feet, and you guide me. And so as the, so one of the first things that happened was, of all of the gifts that I got, several of them were images of Krishna. And even from some of the most unexpected people, like, you know, I got this beautiful Krishna image that was a wedding gift. And the first time I walked into my in-law's house, what I saw was my father-in-law sitting and meditating. And it was as if my, it was for me, sort of validation that I am being heard, that there is this two-way conversation going on. So that sort of helped me settle into my faith a little bit more. And then, of course, I was just 22 then, and, you know, I'm 57 now. And every year, I have, my interpretation of what God is changing, and but I have not lost that connection to whatever you know, however you want to define that, whether it's your higher self, your highest self, the universe, the source, God, whatever word you like to use, but I'm sort of very comfortable in that space now. And I know that there is, like I said, this two-way conversation going on. It's maybe longer than I should. Anyway, that's sort of my journey.
Yeah, there's several things that you shared, but one of the things that really jumped out at me when we had some prior conversations before today's session, and even as you were sharing it in your story, is that something that you were seeking was, in terms of your marriage, your arranged marriage, was to find a family who was spiritual as opposed to religious.
Yeah.
And can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah. So so I know most about Hinduism, but I also went to a Catholic school. So and a Jesuit college. So, but for me, so the way I distinguish between religion and spirituality is religion for me is structure. It is ritualistic, and there is no more ritualistic religion than Hinduism in the world. You know, so if you want to be a dogmatic, ritualistic, pain in the behind kind of person who practices religion, you can find a lot of them who are Hindus. So that was not what I was seeking. So I first of all, I didn't grow up in a family that had, that practiced a lot of rituals. But because of having read the Gita and because of having read, being very familiar with the Bible and the Sermon on the Mount and all of that, and, you know, it had a very wide exposure to all parts, all types of religion and spirituality, and there is also the constant, actually one of the things that you do get if when you grow up in India, if you are open to it, you know, a constant message that was actually consciously taught to was the fact that all the religions are actually the basic message of all the religions is the same. So it was not the ritual that attracted me. So the ritual actually, there is a certain amount that repels me from ritualistic religion, particularly if you're not willing to seek the deeper meaning of the ritual. And so that's not what I was looking for. What I was looking for was, having been through what I had just been through, I knew that there was that I needed more guidance, and I needed to be in a place where there were other seekers. And so that's what I wanted. I did not want to go into a family where they were very rigid about, you know, stupid stuff like if you have your periods, you shouldn't touch other people, or you shouldn't go into the kitchen, or any of those kinds of blind beliefs. So I think one of the advantages maybe for me growing up in India was there is a very stark contrast, and you can see it very easily because you have both types of practicing of religion and spirituality going on all around you. So you see all of these very rigid religious dogmas being propagated, but at the same time you also see the beauty of the and the depth of the religion through people like Vivekananda and you know, Ramakrishna, and so there is such a broad exposure to both aspects of so in its ideal sense, religion is leading you, the purpose of this, you know, the structure of religion is for me to lead you to this higher path of realizing unity with God and realizing that you are a manifestation of God, and that your role in the world is really to manifest that, to you know, to shed all the other parts of yourself, and so that your divinity is shining through. What happens is that people get stuck in this because they're not willing to I'm sorry, Lauren, that is Ella again. That's my little dog, for those of you listening. She seems to be feeling a little restless. But they don't want to go deeper because going deeper will demand something more of them than they're willing to give. so they just feel comfortable and satisfied in doing all of these ritualistic things, you know, doing a sort of reciting the certain verses, shlokas, mindlessly. There'll be people who are reciting this while they're like doing a bunch of other things, not paying any attention to what the words are saying at all. And a lot of us don't even know Sanskrit, so we are reciting verses that we don't know the meanings of. And so there's a lot of this kind of craziness that goes on in practiced religion. And you can see that, but then you also have access to great thinkers like I said, like Vivekananda Aurobindo and all of those magnificent figures who came out of this tradition. And so it's, for those who want, it's possible to see that difference and choose that path. Does that answer your question?
It does. And, you know, it brings forth, you know, what I call, you know, like a myth or misconception in the spiritual world is that we often think that religion and spirituality are different things and that they, you know, they must exist in separate places. But really, like, you know, from the way that I'm understanding you is that the religion is providing a framework or a structure. And from that structure, we can either, you know, kind of utilize the structure in a dogmatic way, you know, with a more literal way, or, you know, which often, it, you know, is about stopping the uniqueness of each of us. It's much more about conformity, that everyone is supposed to, you know, believe exactly in the same way. And yeah. It often goes to extremes where it's kind of sort of the my way or the highway type principles,
mm-hmm.
you know, versus the concept of taking that same religious structure, regardless of what the faith practice is, and bringing it in to the spiritual side where the structure creates a framework within which to explore the true deeper meaning. So, you know, we can be talking about any religion in the world, and in all of those faith practices, there are those that are practicing in the dogmatic sense, and there are those that are practicing in the more deeper spiritual sense. So it's not mutually exclusive that, you know, if you're spiritual, you can't be religious, or if you're religious, that you can't be spiritual. You can be deeply religious and very spiritual simultaneously.
Absolutely. And what has happened for me, actually, as I've grown older and as I have been, funnily enough, I've been exposed to more rituals in Hinduism after moving out of India, and most particularly moving into the United States, because you know, by the time we got here, then there were all of these cities that had temples in there, and so there were all kinds of rituals that you can actually attend and practices for different festivals that you can go to and attend and participate in. And I do that much more now than I ever did when I was growing up. But the way I interpret what I'm doing is very different than what many other people around me probably are doing. So for example, when I go, what is a good example? One of the things that I do now almost every year is around fall, in the fall, there is a 9-day a 10-day festival that celebrates the story of the Divine Mother. And that's what my blog actually explores, the grand story of the Divine Mother. And I've been trying to figure out how it applies to my life and sort of make it very practical for me and for those who are reading it. And so when I'm there, I am not thinking of this goddess that we're worshiping as someone external to me. You know, so there are 3 days of, there are 9 days of very, very highly ritualized worship and the reading of this whole story every day. And what I see, what I imagine as that is being done is the divinity within me being enhanced as I sit through that. And so that for some people that might be blasphemous, you know, because you're thinking about yourself as God or as a goddess, and all of, you know, that is something that you're not supposed to do, people might feel. But that is how I interpret the whole thing, and I am all convinced that is what was meant in all of these scriptures, because they're all allegories. They're none of them, you know, they're not actually saying that there was this goddess with 8 or 16 or 20 arms who came down and did this. Those images have a symbolic meaning, and that symbolic meaning relates directly to your own spiritual practice and advancement. And so it is the other thing that I that might be more accessible to your listeners is the whole idea of Easter and Christ's resurrection. No, so sometimes I hear arguments about whether his actual physical body resurrected or not, and that's not the whole point, you know. So it's again the issue with taking religious scripture to literally and not understanding the symbolic meaning of what that entire episode of resurrection meant, and the fact that it really did, for me, it's still a miracle. I mean, you know, the thought of that the spirit lives on and is the message that resurrection means, gives me. And it doesn't actually matter whether the physical body resurrected or not. That is taking a beautiful allegory for me. In my, this is completely my interpretation. And fighting over something that is really not important because you're missing the message. You know, so I think it's possible and maybe sometimes even desirable to mingle the two in a way that is not dogmatic. It's desirable because the structure helps, and it brings, it gives you a way to focus and sort of times and, you know, it sort of, if you follow the festivals, or if you go to church every Sunday, or if you go to the mosque every Friday, it gives you a structure which helps bring you back to that center and to that conversation with your higher self. And so it helps as long as you don't get bogged down in the minutiae of ritual and literary translations.
And again, you know, we're talking, you know, when we're talking about, you know, like the literal translation versus the symbology and the figurative meaning of what are, you know, what often are seen as parables, that there's an interpretation of these texts that is not meant to be taken literally. Like, there really is a bigger picture and a deeper meaning of what this means for each of us in our lives. And it speaks right into what we've been speaking throughout the summit about the old consciousness perception and modeling versus the new consciousness perception and modeling, where the old concept was very polar and separate, where if we lay that concept over religious practice, God is an entity and an energy separate from us.
Mm-hmm.
It's an entity that we are, supposed to worship and recognize, but not be necessarily connected to. And the new consciousness model is all about relationship and collaboration and integration.
Yeah.
And so the more new consciousness interpretation of religion is that God is within us and expresses through us, as opposed to being a separate being or a separate entity. We are an expression of that divine or universal or God. And again, I often use lots of words because we're really speaking about the same exact thing. We just call it something different based on our own individual come from.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think that's exactly right. And I think a lot of the issues that, and for me as well, one of the funny, sort of ironic things as far as I'm concerned is that definitely in terms of the Hindu scriptures and probably the Buddhist scriptures, I know that depending on which book you're reading, you can see that the point of it, even in the introductions and the interpretations that exist, there is this sense that you are not to take any of this literally. And so even recently we had a ceremony at home, and we had a priest come in and to conduct the ceremony. And one of the first things, he does certain gestures. He lights the lamp and, offers incense and flowers and all of that. But what you do first is you invoke that divinity. He invokes the divinity into himself. That's how the scripture is written. So you are, you can either think of it as bringing the divinity into you or removing your, the things that keep it hidden and exposing the divinity within you. And then often in many of these rituals, the first thing that is done is to honor that divinity so that before anything is given to the external image of the God that you're worshiping, you first, do the same things to yourself. So you put flour on yourself, you put the rice on your own head, you put the water on your... So it, that interpretation is there. Whether you are courageous enough to take it on is a whole different issue, because, like I said before, if you take it on, then there is no more victimhood, right? Then there is no more, all this is happening to me, and I have no power over anything, and therefore, I'm helpless. That sort of doesn't work anymore. And so it sometimes is much easier to say, to think about this God being external and having the power to do to you in your life whatever he or she would like to do. And I think that's why the myth of that separation lives on in several people. Although it's becoming, I think, much more common to talk, you know, this kind of language is so much more common now than it was when I was growing up. So I think we are, there is evidence all around that there is an awakening, that there is a change, that, like you said, you know, when you talk about the new consciousness and the old consciousness, there is definitely the new consciousness that is awake. In a certain sense, there's a consciousness that is being awoken in so many more people than I was aware of before.
Yes, and that's, again, the reason for the summit is that we are moving into a new time, and vibrationally in the universe at large, it's activating our soul, if you will, kind of remotely. And people are beginning to wake up in mass. It's not just one person here and one person there. It's starting to happen, you know, to a much wider cross-section of humanity. And given that we have been trained, very well trained, into the old consciousness models and perceptions, that what's opening up in front of us, we can see it, but we're not equipped to engage it in its form. So one of the greatest challenges that I find many, many people have is they're beginning to embrace the new consciousness model and intention, but they're engaging it with the old consciousness rules and tools, as I call them. And they don't match up. And it's creating a lot of stress because it just simply doesn't work the same way. And there is this beautiful opportunity for us to, you know, again, using that word awaken, and open ourselves up to a new interpretation and a new relationship. And in this conversation, you know, having that new relationship with religion, that many people I speak to, you know, they kind of jokingly say, I'm a recovering, you know, and then fill in the blank. So it's like, I'm a recovering Catholic, I'm a recovering Jew, I'm a recovering Muslim. Like, there's this concept of, like, I have to recover from my religious upbringing and teaching, when in fact, it's not really about recovering from it. It's about engaging it and having relationship with it in a different manner so that it now serves you as opposed to box you in.
Exactly. And it's sort of, in a certain sense, it's reinterpreting the religion in a way that'll help you move ahead to become a much more conscious human being. So you can be a highly spiritual Catholic and similarly with any other religion. And I think what that also does is when you talk about I am a recovering Catholic, or I am a recovering Jew, or you know, I'm a recovering Hindu. What you're also doing is you are rejecting an entire part of yourself, right? You grew up with certain rituals and certain beliefs. And there is this, that's one of the, as you talked about before, that's one of the things that's becoming more and more clear to me in terms of how important it is that we recognize that our entire being is okay. You know, there is no part of ourselves that we should be rejecting. So, because what that rejection is doing is it's pulling apart a certain part of your energy and sort of putting it away in a box, and then you have no, so you lose some of the power that you came into the world with. And I will also send you a link to my blog. I speak to this a lot by using sort of everyday examples in my own life about how I've begun to recognize it. And so I think it's very important for those of us who are spiritually inclined to begin to learn to sort of, I almost want to say, stand up, you know, expand from the center all the way around 360 and embrace every part of our life that was, that is, and that will be, because there is nothing that should be rejected, and all of it is as it should be, in a sense. So one of the things that you, in this scripture that I am talking about, you know, there's a lot of war, there's a, it's very gory, the goddess comes in to kill demons, basically. And what those demons represent are fragmented parts of ourselves. And what happens is that she kills without mercy, because she knows everything is a manifestation of her. So, and as she kills this, her manifestation becomes one with herself. So in a certain sense, what we're doing is when we begin to expand and, you know, recognize the hatred we have within us or the violence tendencies that we have, and instead of separating them out and not looking at them, when we sort of acknowledge them, they lose their power, right? And then they become part of our own power, and that's what that entire myth is about. So it is really important for us not to be rejecting or feeling bad about or feeling ashamed of the fact that we were once practicing Catholics, you know, Protestants, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, whatever. We are all on the same path, and all parts of that path are valid and important and need to be sort of embraced. Albeit from this vantage point of knowing that this path is not just about the ritual and the dogma, but it is about a much broader, greater experience. But from that vantage point, it's important to accept that.
Yes, I think about the concept that I often hear in spiritual, you know, talk and spiritual conversations about, you know, the dark side of us. Like there's a light and a dark side. And I always teach, because I was never able to accept that. Like that never resonated or rang true for me. And how I teach this sense of, you know, acceptance and wholeness is what you're speaking about, that fragmented self. And that there is no such thing as the dark side. Like, we do not have a darkness within us, like an evil within us, where we often talk of good and evil. There's not a part of us that is dark and evil. What is happening is that there are parts of us that have been hidden away in the dark. That we've hidden them, we've put them away so that they are sitting in the dark. But if we, you know, so I use the practical analogy that we there was a part of us that we put into a closet and then shut the door. So that part of us is sitting in the dark, but is not dark itself. And if we were to simply open up the door and allow light in, we would recognize that this part of us, you know, is very much alive and light and beautiful and a part of our experience and our growth and our learning. And it's part of our wholeness, as opposed to it's a dark entity that must be separated and rejected. And again, that concept of darkness, like dark versus light, good versus evil, you know, is very much an old consciousness polarity mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And when we enter into the journey in the new consciousness perspective, it's really about, again, embracing the wholeness of ourselves and realizing that the separation that we thought existed is not real.
Yeah.
It's not real. And the power comes from allowing that old belief to dissolve and allowing all of that energy to come together, as you had shared, that, you know, it was like bringing all these fragmented pieces back together into an energetic whole. And it's just such a beautiful way of sharing, you know, the concept that, you know, or even this conversation, which is so taboo in our culture, and it really doesn't need to be. It's a beautiful conversation of being able to, you know, to blend the religious structure along with spirituality, if that is in fact your come from. You don't have to deny a part of who you are. I always talk about, it's not an either or, it's a both and. How do we bring them together into something more powerful?
Absolutely.
Oh, such an amazing conversation. And, you know, again, I could go on for hours speaking deep philosophy. But I understand that you have a gift for our listeners. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. This is a guided meditation. I have to be honest, it's the first guided meditation that I ever recorded. So, what it is is speaking a little bit to this idea of fragmentation, and it's in the context of us, of there being some task or something that you know you should be doing, but you're terrified of doing it. It could be as simple as doing a meditative writing exercise every day, or doing your workout, whatever it is, or it could be something much bigger, as in your life purpose. I've recorded it as if it's a task that you want to do in a certain time. And it takes you through the first making you aware of your sort of fully embodying yourself, so coming into your body fully, and understanding that cohesiveness that exists when you're fully embodied, fully in your body. Then I ask you to think about this, that thing that you want to do, and you recognize how quickly, as soon as a fear or a negative emotion comes in, that there's that fragmentation of energy, and there is a constriction of energy in some part of your body, and then I take you through bringing that energy back in lovingly and holding, bringing, coming back into cohesion. So there'll be a link that you have. You'll have Lauren in your email that went out with the interview, and then you'll be able to download that for free. I will also send you a link to my blog, which I hope your listeners will enjoy listening to and sort of trying to apply it, even though it seems like it's a Hindu scripture. The way I interpret it is through everyday life, so I think it will resonate. At least I hope it will. Those are the two things that are coming the way of your listeners.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much for both of those beautiful gifts and your blog as well. I love that you're sharing that link because, again, you're talking about bringing the philosophy into life, and it's the practical form and the practical application, because leaving things in philosophy is part of the greatest challenge, because we can't move it into form. And that's something that you do so beautifully. So thank you so much for sharing those gifts. And thank you so much for your willingness to be here and have this conversation, because it's such an important and powerful piece of spirituality that often gets, again, fragmented or separated out, and it really, truly does not need to be. So thank you so much for bringing your wisdom and your perspective to help people kind of become more whole again in their faith practice along their spiritual journey. So thank you so
much.
Thank you
so much,
Lauren.
I have been honored to be a part of this, and this is an area that I love to talk about. So thank you so much for having me, and great success. Wishing you great success with this summit.
Thank you so much. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us. Until next time, be well and live a successful, spiritually inspired life.